3. Malibu. There was a smell in the house. It had always been there. It belonged to time and the salt air and the entropic nature of expensive houses built too close to the sea. Perhaps it was also peculiar to places briefly but frequently uninhabited. Houses opened and closed as their restless residents arrived and departed. She imagined the rooms empty, flecks of corrosion blossoming silently on chrome, pale molds taking hold in obscure corners. The architects, as if in recognition of eternal processes, had encouraged a degree of rust. Massive steel railings along the deck had been eaten wrist-thin by years of spray. The house crouched, like its neighbors, on fragments of ruined foundations, and her walks along the beach sometimes involved attempts at archaeological fantasy. She tried to imagine a past for the place, other houses, other voices. She was accompanied on those walks by an armed remote, a tiny Dornier helicopter that rose from its unseen rooftop nest when she stepped down from the deck. It could hover almost silently, and was programmed to avoid her line of sight. There was something wistful about the way it followed her, as though it were an expensive but unappreciated Christmas gift. She knew that Hilton Swift was watching through the Dornier's cameras. Little that occurred in the beach house escaped SenseNet. Her solitude, the week alone she'd demanded, was under constant surveillance. Her years in the profession had conveyed a singular immunity to observation. At night she sometimes lit the floods mounted beneath the deck, illuminating the hieroglyphic antics of huge gray sand fleas. The deck itself she left in darkness, and the sunken living room behind her. She sat on a chair of plain white plastic, watching the Brownian dance of the fleas. In the glare of the floods they cast minute, barely visible shadows, fleeting cusps against the sand. The sound of the sea wrapped her in its movement. Late at night, as she slept in the smaller of the two guest bedrooms, it worked its way into her dreams, but never into the stranger's invading memories. The choice of bedrooms was instinctive. The master bedroom was mined with the triggers of old pain. The doctors at the clinic had used chemical pliers to pry the addiction away from receptor sites in her brain. She cooked for herself in the white kitchen, thawing bread in the microwave, dumping packets of dehydrated Swiss soup into spotless steel pans, edging dully into the nameless but increasingly familiar space from which she'd been so subtly insulated by the designer's dust. "It's called life," she said to the white counter. And what would SenseNet's in-house psychs make of that, she wondered, if some hidden microphone caught it and carried it to them. She stirred the soup with a slender stainless whisk, watching steam rise. It helped to do things, she thought, just to do things yourself. At the clinic, they'd insisted she make her own bed. Now she spooned out her own bowl of soup, frowning, remembering the clinic. She'd checked herself out a week into the treatment. The medics protested. The detoxification had gone beautifully, they said, but the therapy hadn't begun. They pointed out the rate of relapse among clients who failed to complete the program. They explained that her insurance was invalid if she terminated her treatment. SenseNet would pay, she told them, unless they preferred she pay them herself. She produced her platinum Mitsubank chip. Her lire arrived an hour later. She told it to take her to LAX, ordered a car to meet her there, and canceled all incoming calls. "I'm sorry, Angela," the jet said, banking over Montego Bay seconds after they'd taken off, "but I have Hilton Swift on executive override." "Angie," Swift said, "you know I'm behind you all the way. You know that, Angie." She turned to stare at the black oval of the speaker. It was centered in smooth gray plastic, and she imagined him crouching back there, his long runner's legs folded painfully, grotesquely, behind the Lear's bulkhead. "I know that, Hilton," she said. "It's nice of you to phone."
"You're going to L.A., Angie?"
"Yes, that's what I told the plane."
"To Malibu?"
"That's right."
"Piper Hill is on her way to the airport."
"Thank you, Hilton, but I don't want Piper there. I don't want anybody. I want a car.
There's no one at the house, Angie.
Good. That's what I want, Hilton. No one at the house. The house empty.
Are you certain that's a good idea?
It's the best idea I've had in a long time, Hilton.
There was a pause. They said it went really well, Angie, the treatment, but they wanted you to stay.
I need a week, she said. 1 week. 7 days. Alone.
After her third night in the house, she woke at dawn, made coffee, dressed. Condensation stippled the broad window facing the deck. Sleep had been simply that. If dreams had come, she couldn't recall them. But there was something, a quickening, almost a giddiness. She stood in the kitchen, feeling the cold of the ceramic floor through thick white sweat socks, both hands around the warm cup. Something there. She extended her arms, raising the coffee like a chalice, the gesture at once instinctive and ironic. It had been 3 years since the Loa had ridden her, 3 years since they had touched her at all. But now? Legba, one of the others. The sense of a presence receded abruptly. She put the cup down on the counter too quickly, coffee slopping over her hand, and ran to find shoes and a coat. Green rubber boots from the beach closet, and a heavy blue mountain jacket she didn't remember, too large to have been Bobby's. She hurried out of the house, down the stairs, ignoring the hum of the toy Dornier's prop as it lifted off behind her like a patient dragonfly. She glanced north, along the jumble of beach houses, the confusion of roof lines reminding her of a Rio barrio, then turned south, toward the colony. The one who came was named Maman Brigitte, or Grande Brigitte, and while some think her the wife of Baron Samedi, others name her Most Ancient of the Dead. The dream architecture of the colony rose to Angie's left, a riot of form and ego. Frail-looking neon-embedded replicas of the Watts Towers lifted beside neo-brutalist bunkers faced with bronze bas-reliefs. Walls of mirror, as she passed, reflected morning banks of Pacific cloud. There had been times, during the past 3 years, when she had felt as though she were about to cross, or recross, a line, a subtle border of faith, to find that her time with the Loa had been a dream, or at most that they were contagious knots of cultural resonance remaining from the weeks she'd spent in Beauvoir's New Jersey Umfor. To see with other eyes, no gods, no horsemen. She walked on, comforted by the surf, by the one perpetual moment of beach time, the now and always of it. Her father was dead, 7 years dead, and the record he'd kept of his life had told her little enough. That he'd served someone or something, that his reward had been knowledge, and that she had been his sacrifice. Sometimes she felt as though she'd had 3 lives, each walled away from the others by something she couldn't name, and no hope of wholeness, ever. There were the child's memories of the Mas Arcology, carved into the summit of an Arizona mesa, where she'd hugged a sandstone balustrade, face into the wind, and felt as though the whole hollowed tableland was her ship, that she could steer out into those sunset colors beyond the mountains. Later she'd flown away from there, her fear a hard thing in her throat. She could no longer recall her last glimpse of her father's face, though it must have been on the microlight deck, the other planes tethered against the wind, a row of rainbow moths. The first life ended that night. Her father's life had ended too. Her second life had been a short one, fast and very strange. A man called Turner had taken her away, out of Arizona, and had left her with Bobby and Beauvoir and the others. She remembered little about Turner, only that he was tall, with hard muscles and a hunted look. He'd taken her to New York. Then Beauvoir had taken her, along with Bobby, to New Jersey. There, on the 53rd level of a MINCOM structure, Beauvoir had taught her about her dreams. "The dreams are real," he'd said, his brown face shining with sweat.
He taught her the names of the ones she'd seen in dreams. He taught her that all dreams reach down to a common sea, and he showed her the way in which hers were different and the same. "You alone sail the old sea and the new," he said. She was ridden by gods in New Jersey. She learned to abandon herself to the horsemen. She saw the Loa Linglesu enter Beauvoir in the Umphor, saw his feet scatter the diagrams outlined in white flower. She knew the gods in New Jersey, and love. The Loa had guided her when she'd set out with Bobby to build her third, her current life. They were well matched, Angie and Bobby, born out of vacuums. Angie from the clean, blank kingdom of Maas Biolabs, and Bobby from the boredom of Berrytown. Grande Brigitte touched her without warning. She stumbled, almost fell to her knees in the surf, as the sound of the sea was sucked away into the twilit landscape that opened in front of her. The whitewashed cemetery walls, the gravestones, the willows, the candles. Beneath the oldest willow, a multitude of candles, the twisted roots pale with wax. "Child, know me." And Angie felt her there all at once, and knew her for what she was, Maman Brigitte, Mademoiselle Brigitte, eldest of the dead. "I have no cult, child, no special altar." She found herself walking forward, into candle glow, a buzzing in her ears, as though the willow hid a vast hive of bees. "My blood is vengeance." Angie remembered Bermuda, night, a hurricane. She and Bobby had ventured out into the eye. Grande Brigitte was like that. The silence, the sense of pressure, of unthinkable forces held momentarily in check. There was nothing to be seen beneath the willow, only the candles. "The Loa. I can't call them. I felt something. I came looking." "You are summoned to my reposoir. Hear me. Your father drew Veve in your head. He drew them in a flesh that was not flesh. You were consecrated to Ezili Freda. Legba led you into the world to serve his own ends. But you were sent poison, child, a coup poudre." Her nose began to bleed. "Poison? Your father's Veve are altered, partially erased, redrawn. Though you have ceased to poison yourself, still the horsemen cannot reach you. I am of a different order." There was a terrible pain in her head, blood pounding in her temples. "Please, hear me. You have enemies. They plot against you. Much is at stake in this. Fear poison, child." She looked down at her hands. The blood was bright and real. The buzzing sound grew louder. Perhaps it was in her head. "Please, help me. Explain. You cannot remain here. It is death." And Angie fell to her knees in the sand, the sound of the surf crashing around her, dazzled by the sun. The Dornier was hovering nervously in front of her, 2 meters away. The pain receded instantly. She wiped her bloodied hands on the sleeves of the blue jacket. The remote's cluster of cameras whirred and rotated. "It's all right," she managed. "A nosebleed. It's only a nosebleed." The Dornier darted forward, then back. "I'm going back to the house now. I'm fine." It rose smoothly out of sight. Angie hugged herself, shaking. "No. Don't let them see. They'll know something happened, but not what." She forced herself to her feet, turned, began to trudge back up the beach the way she'd come. As she walked, she searched the mountain jacket's pockets for a tissue, anything, something to wipe the blood from her face. When her fingers found the corners of the flat little packet, she knew instantly what it was. She halted, shivering. The drug.
It wasn't possible. Yes, it was. But who? She turned and stared at the Dornier until it slid away. The packet. Enough for a month. Coup poudre. Fear poison, child.